Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Chauncey the Bear, Jim's imaginary friend. And I have been this whole time.
It explains why we don't have that many listeners. It's just long swaths of complete silence.
Yeah, or it's just Jim going like, but Chauncey, I don't want to review Imaginary. It hurts. Please don't make me do it.
Yeah, it does hurt a little bit. Imaginary is quite bad.
It is a new low, or should I say, a new wad low for our... Jeff, thank you. I was going to table this until after the break. I don't think that I can. I made a ruling not long ago that William Brent Bell was my favorite of the Unholy Trinity, the one that I had the most affection for. This was a post Lord of Misrule evaluation.
I think that's fair.
I think Jeff Wadlow is definitely the worst.
Yeah, it's those two and Adam Robitel. Do we have like a fourth horseman in there?
I thought we did. I think that they kind of work in shifts.
A little bit, yeah.
But part of their crime is being unmemorable, and so it's hard to get that bent out of shape. You know, shake your fist and go, oh, you again. But after a certain point, enough is enough. I mean, I was looking over his filmography, and granted, there's one or two items on there that I have not seen, but the standout for me is Fantasy Island, which is just like a good bad, so bad it's good kind of.
That's what I was about to say. Fantasy Island, which was not his most recent film, but the most recent one we've reviewed prior to this, is very much fun bad. I mean, we had so much fodder for our episode, and for years since, Matt and I will periodically just say to one another, "Welcome to Fantasy Island."
Yes.
Whether in person to one another apropos of nothing or doing this podcast. But nothing from Imaginary will achieve anything like that. It's impossible.
No, there's nothing mimetic in there to latch on to. Although, talking about it now, there's a commonality there that I'm kind of struck by, which is Fantasy Island, which does get incredibly doofy, as I recall, in the third act, you know, with magic and sorcery and all kinds of flim-flam. Right. But it's relatively grounded compared to where today's movie goes in its back half. And yet...
True.
Fantasy Island has more fun with its less ambitious take on, you know, the power of imagination and dreams and wishes and all that crap. Imagination! Yeah. Imaginary could do almost anything, and it does next to nothing. And yes. So when you hold it up to Fantasy Island, not a sterling standard, but even still, it falls well short of the standard set by that movie.
Dramatically short. So the film is about a woman whose name is Jessica. I pulled that as I was beginning the sentence. I didn't remember the name when I'm the names guy.
Right.
Spells doom.
Yeah, I know that I'm mentally infirm when it comes to this specific thing, so I did write them down. It's Jessica, and her husband is named Max, and then Max has two kids from a previous marriage named Alice and Taylor, and yes. I did not write down which is the older one. I think Taylor is the older one.
Yes, that is accurate. So she's a stepmom, and there's some tension there, mostly with the older daughter. The younger one seems to be rather taken with her. They move into the house where she grew up. It was being occupied by some relative or other. It's not particularly clear and really doesn't matter, but they move in there, and Alice makes an imaginary friend named Chauncey, or Chauncey Bear, in the form of this rather innocuous-looking teddy bear.
Yeah, or CB, which is his MC name, I guess. that he's cryptically called by at various points, and we're not supposed to know who that is.
Yeah, just no idea. Well, I think they try to throw us off the scent by spelling it like S-E-A-B-E-E, which, whatever, I'm not going to get into that.
I'm not, no, don't even dignify it. That's an insulting smokescreen.
But I'm just going to say, I'm not sure that under other circumstances, I would have been susceptible to being afraid of a stuffed bear, but Seth MacFarlane made it impossible. You see the stuffed bear, and it's just Ted. I mean, it's a substantially different design, but the broad strokes are, it's Ted. You just at the stuffed bear, and you expect to start talking like a knockoff Peter Griffin, because he does basically that voice.
Well, and let's dig into this, because Chauncey is not a scary bear. He does not look, there's nothing about his design that is in any way evocative of fear or even unease. There's a bit in the movie where a child psychologist shows up to evaluate Alice, and I was reminded of the scene near the beginning of The Shining after Danny has his fainting spell in the bathroom and the child shrink shows up. And in that scene, Danny is resting against a bear that is way scarier looking than Chauncey, despite not being the actual, you know, nexus of the threat in the movie in any tangible sense. He's just a little bit of set dressing. Kubrick worked him into the mise-en-scene just to, you know, give us the willies on a pseudo-subliminal level. Whereas Chauncey is the star of the show, and he can't even compete with this random
throwaway
Teddy Ruxpin knockoff. Yeah, it's embarrassing. Unbelievable.
Yeah. So as it turns out, Chauncey the Bear, up to no good. And there's a whole bunch of lore, because studio horror movies of this ilk cannot fucking help themselves.
This is the most egregious one we've seen in quite some time. I was kind of astonished by how deep the lore dumps were.
I have a smartass remark to make at a certain point in our synopsis that I think will encapsulate my essential feelings about the lore and the dumps in this film. So
let's not waste any time then. To the film's credit, it does kind of hit the ground running on eight legs, to be precise, because we open with a nightmare, the first of many, especially in the first half of the movie, in which Jessica is being pursued by some kind of a spider monster. And then she comes to, we're shown that she's a children's book author. She has a series of books that she's hard at work on about Simon the spider.
Well, I think it's more principally about Molly the Millipede. And then she's the protagonist, and then Simon the Spider is a, like, antagonist that breaks good, I think, ultimately.
That
Simon the Spider has an arc.
that's grim. That's true. So Jessica's got two adopted kids that she's chafing against to a small or large degree. Taylor, the teenage daughter, is giving her more guff. Alice, the younger daughter, is relatively easy to get along with, but it's Alice, the younger one, who finds Chauncey Bear, CB to his friends, in the basement, and then starts being a stock horror movie kind of
creepy kid
about it. So it's weird, and this is only just kind of coming into focus for me now. And you talked about this before we even got into the plot synopsis. Jessica's real beef is with Taylor, or should I, you know, more accurately, Taylor has beef with Jessica because you're not my mom, you know, the drill. But it's Alice who's having the paranormal problems. So the movie is at kind of cross purposes there. I'm not saying that they necessarily had to be collapsed into one character because that might be too tidy. But what ends up happening is that Jessica and Taylor bond during the climax when they have to resolve this crisis together. And the long and the short of it is that Alice, who's the one who's actually having the problem, first and foremost, barely gets to be a character, you know, which
she's an object.
Right. She's just a stereotype, the, you know, stereotypical creepy horror movie kid. But that's the least of the climax's problems, frankly.
For sure.
So we dig Chauncey Bear out of the basement, and right away, Alice is ceding too much of her kind of free time and her imaginative play to Chauncey. He seems to be making her do things kind of sort of against her will, you know, like making her go on these scavenger hunts. At one point, I think they're reading a book together, and she's like, you know, well, I don't want to read this book, Chauncey. It's tough shit, kid, you know. I call the shots around here. I'm Chauncey the Bear.
Do you know who I am?
It seems like Chauncey also uncorks something creatively inside of Jessica, because she had been having writer's block, and then she starts writing more. The movie is at cross purposes with regards to Simon the Spider, Chauncey the Bear. Are they one and the same? Who can say? It's like the movie gets off for me on a very strong foot, me being an arachnophobe. I was right. Like, oh shit, okay. It's like a spider inside of a bear chrysalis of some kind. You know? But it is a bear 99% of the time. I did think there's multiple fake outs toward the end, and I have to say, the last of them is so egregious that I really did think the movie was about to be over, and that we had not been given another morsel of arachnid. And then we get like a piddly little sprinkling of spider right at the very end. Uh-huh. I don't know. There's just the waters there are awfully muddy in terms of the entity that we're dealing with. And, you know, whether you're an arachnophobe or not, I would think that spiders are scarier than teddy bears. You know, it's yeah, like
even if you make the teddy bear large with snaggly teeth, which is basically all they do.
Once that happens, it's even sillier looking. I thought it gets like Wampa proportions with like big hunched up shoulders.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like something that should be menacing you on like the Matterhorn bobsled ride at Disneyland. It's just like a kind of cheap looking animatronic. Anyway, I have no idea why you would even dangle the spider in front of us if you're not going to make good on it. Lots and lots and lots of nightmares in the first act, two acts of the movie in order to pad things out. And then when the nightmares abate, that's when we start getting lore drops to pad things out. So the movie is overstuffed and padded to excess start to finish.
Which is crazy, because it's not like this is one of those movies that's inexplicably 2 hours or 2 hours and change.
No.
It's 104 minutes, including credits, which means it's about 97. And yet it had to be padded out to that length. At its core, this film is 75 minutes long.
Yes, spiritually. It's like a Roger Corman, like 61 minute, half of a double feature drive-in movie.
Yeah.
The only interesting curveball, and I guess you could call it padding because nothing ever really comes of it, but the only interesting wrinkle in this first half is a jump scare where Jessica gets jumped by her adopted daughter's bio mom, who has, I think, broken free of a mental institution. She winds up getting carted off by police and EMTs, and it's revealed that Taylor, the elder daughter, had been texting her, you know, tearfully. She's going, I thought she was getting better. So the idea that there's a potentially violent and unhinged other mother out there is tantalizing. But like the spider, it is almost like a perverse glimpse into a better movie that might have been. I mean, I genuinely don't know why, unless it is just how he gets his sick kicks. Like he's so... I don't know, just like huffing the paint of his own mediocrity, it seems to me. I don't know why you would keep teasing us with these other movies that could go off in some kind of an interesting direction, and then it just never happens. I don't think we ever see the bio mom again outside of a hallucination near the end.
Yeah, no, we don't.
So, let's see. Jessica has an ailing father who is not in his right mind. And she goes to visit him, and I don't remember what sets him off, but he starts ranting about her childhood and about He's very visibly afraid. He starts going, CB, CB.
You won't stop talking to that CB.
Yeah, and before the movie even gets a chance to throw up its flimsy smokescreen with the alternate spelling, Jessica's like, what do you mean CB? Like a radio? What are you talking about? And correct me if I'm wrong, but a CB radio is letter C, letter B, is it not? I mean,
I believe so, yeah.
So the movie plants that in your head and then tries to waffle on it. Like, oh no, it's spelled S whatever. Just unbelievably patronizing. And this is intercut with Taylor having a friend over who drops a bottle of booze that he's pilfered from the parents' liquor cabinet.
He's not even a friend. He's just this neighbor guy who might be a couple years older who was perving on her a little bit.
Yeah.
And she's, I don't know, desperate for attention or a distraction or whatever it is. And so she invites him over and he immediately makes himself a nuisance to her. Like, she's clearly already rapidly losing interest after been there for about 10 minutes.
Well, he picks up the bottle and immediately drops it, and it shatters everywhere, spills everywhere. He's not even drunk when it happens or messed up in any way, because we come to find out that the baggie of E
what's
or whatever
supposed to be Molly,
it turns out
it's his mom's allergy meds.
Right, exactly. So he's just a complete doofus, but not really in a fun way. It's another go-nowhere character. We never see him again.
But no, we see him again. When the time comes, I'll point him out.
Yes, do enlighten me when the time comes. But for the time being, his only purpose is to get spooked by Chauncey in a truly farcical sequence.
Yeah, but he doesn't... Well, okay, I won't ruin it. But the one thing I will say about this sequence is when he thinks he's seeing things, he tries to comfort himself by saying, you're tripping. So, which
that placebo effect is a motherfucker, I guess.
Like, is he so stupid that he believed the allergy meds were Molly? Because the only thing that makes any semblance of sense is that he brought over this baggie to impress a girl he's trying to fondle, essentially. And if he actually thinks they're, like, drugs, what the fuck? This kid is a moron.
Yeah, he's kind of compellingly stupid. He acts concussed every minute that he's on screen, and there's never an adequate explanation for it. But, Chauncey is under a blanket, slides towards him down a long, dimly lit hallway, and then, brah, it's Cocaine Bear, basically, springs into frame for 1 second. But then he
doesn't get eaten.
No.
Like, this is the horror film social contract.
Guy with no redeeming characteristics.
None whatsoever is also completely inessential to the plot. Jeff Wadlow, you're supposed to have him get eaten. It's just what you do.
No, he's only interested in eating his audience.
Yeah, and it's not like, yeah, okay, when you subvert expectations, that can be great. But it's not like not having him get eaten subverts expectations in an interesting way. It just deprives us of one of the few potential sources of small pleasure we could take from this movie, which is watching this douchebag get eaten by a monster.
Yeah, once again, I think it does have to amount to some kind of strange sadomasochistic game. Like, it's so obviously the correct thing to do that when it doesn't happen, it's like the bio mom never coming back or the spider being horribly underutilized. It's something is happening here. I don't like what I'm party to. It just makes me feel a little unclean. So there's a germ of an interesting idea developing with the Alice character, the younger daughter. Because Chauncey's games and his scavenger hunts are becoming more and more sinister. She is sitting at a picnic table that has, you know, a railroad spike sticking up out of it, basically. This gigantic nail.
She had to pull a plank off of, like, a fence and then walked it over to the table. And the plank has a nail sticking out of it.
I completely missed that. I just figured that table was just not up to code.
No.
Jessica and Max, not exactly parent of the year material. Max is also kind of like a total absentee. It's very strange. You know, you,
well,
you
yeah,
would
he's,
think that.
He's like, it's like they wrote a screenplay originally about a single mom and her two daughters, and it didn't have any room for a dad, and then they're like, wait, what if they're stepdaughters? And that creates some conflict and baggage. Like, well, then the dad has to be part of it. Let's put the dad in. And then when shit starts hitting the fan, they didn't know what to do with the dad. So, like, yeah, he's a musician. He's going on tour.
Yeah. Off you go.
Bye.
Have a safe trip, honey.
And then there's a series of, I'm not even kidding, one-sided phone calls.
Yeah.
Jessica calls him at least twice in the second and third act. And, yeah, we don't hear his voice at all.
Yeah, it's much like our listeners can't hear my voice right now because...
Because your voice isn't real.
Yeah, right.
It's all in my head, yes.
So I want to like this scene with the nail. If it had been dealt with a little differently, I think I would have liked it. But you cut immediately from Alice preparing to impale the palm of her hand, to stigmata herself, basically, on the nail. She goes, "Promise it won't hurt." And then it cuts to Jessica finding her list of items to scavenge. And the last one is something that hurts. And it's like, kid, is this or is this not your handwriting? You know, like, did Chauncey write this? Like, you know it's going to hurt. That is the objective of the scavenger hunt. What a stupid question. Promise it won't hurt. It better hurt or you're going to have to find something that does.
You're going to have to do this again.
So, like, if you cut that line, the promise it won't hurt line, and you have Jessica just stumble upon the list of scavenger hunt goodies, then that could have been a frightening moment. Because you don't know if the kid's about to stick her hand in a fucking blender or what. Or, you know, jump off the roof, stick a fucking paperclip in a light socket. It could be any number of things. That would be a scary sequence in theory. But instead, we know exactly what's about to happen. And there's that brain hemorrhaging detail of the kid not realizing it's going to hurt for some reason.
Well, not to mention, this wouldn't have really salvaged this sequence, but at least it might have had a modicum, a sliver of impact if the kid actually, you know, impaled her hand with the nail, but Jessica gets there in time to shove the board out of the way, so it just like a tiny little scratch on Alice's wrist.
Yeah. The whole thing plays,
it's just a complete non-entity.
The whole thing plays like a just kind of gutless version of the part in Skinamarink where the entity tells the kid to stick the knife in her eye.
Yeah.
You know, compared to that, I mean, this is Caillou.
Soft as baby shit.
So now the child psychologist shows up. This is the scene that called to mind The Shining for me. The big takeaway from this scene is supposed to be that, we see Alice and her doppelganger. She's speaking for Chauncey, and we hear the back and forth, and Chauncey is berating her and saying this violent would-be scary stuff. And there's an odd shot where Alice turns to the camera and it's not Chauncey's voice, it's her voice keeps talking, channeling Chauncey, but her lips aren't moving. And it's kind of framed like it's from the Shrink's POV, but it's not explicitly supernatural. Like the child psychologist doesn't hit the ceiling going like, what the fuck? It's not like a moment of escalation like you'd get in like Poltergeist or something like that where the chairs stack themselves. It's just puzzling.
But it should be.
Right.
Because, I mean, the way that this sequence doesn't work is really all a matter of nuance. And I don't know whether it's just because of the way it's shot or if Wadfuck didn't direct the actors properly. So where the psychologist's mind goes is like a refuge, like to try and explain this logically. She asks, has Alice picked up any new hobbies? Ventriloquism, for instance.
Just, you know, by way of example.
because that's something that a lot of 8-year-olds fucking pick up.
A lot of troubled 8-year-olds become extremely accomplished ventriloquists at the drop of a hat. That's definitely what's going on.
Well, and that's exactly it. She would have to be an incredibly accomplished ventriloquist because there's like, you don't see any like muscles flexing in the throat. There's not even the slightest jaw movement at all, which frankly, as far as I know, I'm not an extensive ventriloquism enthusiast, consumer, whatever, but anytime I've seen ventriloquism depicted on screen exclusively, I don't think I've ever seen it done in person. There's always a little, just a tiny little bit of mouth movement, even with professional ventriloquists.
Right.
And there's nothing. It's just, it's a completely disembodied version of her voice coming from elsewhere. But if the psychologist had looked more she looks like freaked out a bit, but if she had looked really unsettled and then her asking about ventriloquism came off more desperate, just completely grasping at straws, like has she been like doing ventriloquism? Would have kind of
with Ouija boards, perhaps.
You know, it could have maybe sold that at least a bit, but yeah, it's just a complete dead letter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a skeptic down to my bones, to the point where if I saw something flat out impossible with my own two eyes, I would also resort to whatever mundane explanations I thought I could cling to. But you have to see the edifice of that skepticism start to crack a little in a movie, if it is explicitly a supernatural thing that you've witnessed. The other thing that drives me nuts about this scene is that the key takeaway, I think, is meant to be that Alice starts repeating this phrase, never, ever, in a variety of contexts, but just, you know, like, you'll never get away from me, never, ever, that kind of thing. And this is something that Jessica used to say when she was a kid, but it's not anywhere near unique enough for that to be sinister, you know?
No.
It's like, as a mantra, it's a very common phrase, and it got a kiddish kind of inflection to it, you know? It's like, when I was a kid, I probably said never ever because there was a track by that name by the English girl group All Saints on Now That's What I Call Music Volume 1. You know, when I was bumping that when I was 7 or 8, it doesn't sound scary, and it's nowhere near singular enough for it to be an eerie coincidence. It doesn't even feel like a coincidence.
It would be bad enough if that was supposed to be a kind of mantra. Chauncey will never let me go. Never, ever. The one thing, thankfully, Chauncey never has his own voice, because that would have just been dumb as hell. But if he had had his own voice and was saying, like, never, ever, during the climax, I get what you're doing. It would have been dumb, but I get what you're doing. But what makes this even more baffling is that never, ever is not meant to be a denial of something. It's meant to be a place. It's the further, but it's called the never, ever.
Right.
Which is, we've bust through the bottom of the barrel and are just digging to China.
I mean, the title of the movie is imaginary, for Christ's sake. You know, I mean, it doesn't get much. All the good adjectives are taken. It's like we had our last hurrah with Hereditary. Now it's like we've got nothing left in terms of, you know, punchy titles like that.
The next shit bucket horror movie that Jeff Wadlow directs is going to be about like an absorbed triplet in the womb. It's going to be called Tertiary.
All right, triplicate.
Oh no, that's so much worse.
So amusingly, and I feel like there's another character that we haven't touched on yet, who I think we've seen once or twice, who's this old nanny of Jessica's, who becomes a major player when we get to the never ever,
right?
Hilariously. But for the time being, there's her off to the side, and then there's the child psychologist. And what the child psychologist does here, I think, really probably should have been offloaded onto the nanny, because the nanny is ultimately revealed to be bugfuck nuts. But in the short term, the child psychologist kind of winds up sounding like a huge crank, because she starts, I think I remember this right, I think it's her, she like shows Jessica a tape of some other kid who has an imaginary friend named Riley Rabbit, and then this kid went missing, and so the child shrink has this theory that children across the world, across, you know, a range of cultures, are being abducted by their own imaginary friends who are vengeful, jealous creatures who don't like being neglected as the child grows older. And putting all of that in this relatively sober character's mouth is just a huge fucking stretch. And this is where we get into lore country and we never get out again. We are done with our trip to Nightmare Town, but now the movie gets just as badly bogged down with nonstop lore dumps. And a lot of them do come from that nanny character.
So the nanny character in question fancies herself some kind of imaginary friend scholar, basically. Like, she's self-published multiple books about the phenomenon and the deeper meanings behind it and so forth. So it seems to be a no-brainer that the stuff that, as you say, the movie forces to come out of the mouth of the otherwise seemingly pretty normal child psychologist, it should have come out of the ex-nanny's mouth. It makes too much sense. The only thing that would be trickier is that the video in question is like from a psychology session, an analysis session. And so you might ask the question like, okay, well, how did she get her hands on this? You know, if she's not the psychologist. But that's ultimately who gives a shit. Like, nobody's asking that question, really. If she had just, like, hand-waved it, like, I found this video somewhere. Who cares?
On the internet. We all know what year it is, you know? It doesn't have to be your field of expertise. No, I agree. And the weirdest thing about putting any of this stuff in the mouth of the child shrink character is that it would be one thing if she, you know, sized up Alice and was shaken by the experience and it reminded her of one specific standout case of an unsolved child abduction that has been stuck in her craw for X number of years. But she doesn't talk about it that way. I mean, she plays tape of one kid in particular. She's asking the kid, you know, tell me about Riley Rabbit, which is the name of their imaginary BFF. But she doesn't talk about it as a standout moment from her career. She just talks about it like it's, you know, it's just this phenomenon that I've noticed. The kids tend to go missing after talking about their imaginary friends too much. What can you do? It comes with the territory. Like, she's very, she's weirdly complacent about it.
Yeah.
It'd be like, you know, if you hired an exterminator to, like, get rid of your roach problem and they just casually alluded to the fact that, like, 9-foot roaches had been, you know, eating people children alive. Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. I don't think so.
No, I don't think that's a thing. Oh, yeah, no, it happens all the time. I just read a story out of Rio de Janeiro. It was like 14 kids were eaten by one giant roach.
Right, one giant roach wiped out a whole quinceañera. I'm surprised you didn't see anything about that.
Side note, I recently rewatched Signs.
Oh, very good.
I was reminded
Vomino's children
of when you quoted that on a recent episode. Come on, children, Vomino's.
So we get into the further after some more exposition and some more lore. The nanny character really comes to kind of monopolize the movie in a way that I found intensely grating.
Yeah, no. So Alice goes missing because she goes into the never ever further earther, and she like paints herself this little door in a crawl space, which is apparently we find where Jessica painted a door when she was a child to go to the same place. And of course Jessica and Taylor are running around trying to find her, and they look outside in the neighborhood first, and then Jessica's like, Taylor, listen, I know this is going to sound crazy, I think she went to the never ever. I mean, there's a little more to it than that, but that's basically what she says. And Taylor's like, you're fucking nuts. I'm going to walk the block again. At which point she runs into the nanny, a bit of a jump scare nanny bursting out of the bushes moment almost.
Yeah.
And this is my glib commentary on the lore dumps that I was previewing earlier. in all of these movies, shit bucket studio horror movies that we complain about, the period of the protagonists going to research stuff, whether it's just going to Google or search, or whether they go to a library, or whether they talk to random individuals they find from the internet or whatever, that's all protagonist driven.
Well, this is such
in this
ambush.
Case, it's an ambush. This ancillary character is forcing this research down the protagonist's throats.
Yes,
it's a hijacking.
That's exactly what it feels like. And then she gets all full of piss and vinegar and just steamrolls over the movie for like 10 to 20 minutes. She's blathering on and on. I became consumed. My life's work, my obsession. Blah, blah, blah. She goes on and on and on. And they reference the Pixar movie Inside Out more than once. You know,
Taylor says Bing Bong at least half a dozen times.
Yeah, so she's like, you're saying Bing Bong is real? And then the nanny goes, well, I know that sounds odd. It's like, well, that's not the word. Actually, the word asinine would have been closer to the tip of my tongue, but odd is good. It's like, Chauncey Bear is already not scary. I don't know how scary your Freddy Krueger du jour would have to be in order for you to liken him to Bing Bong and get away with it. But Chauncey ain't it. He's not that guy. You cannot afford to defang him any further than he already is, just fresh out of the box. He has no fangs, figuratively.
Yeah,
of course.
Literally, he definitely has
a snarling maw. Yeah, right.
And we get that this character, that Taylor, does not believe in any of this stuff yet, and so she's being deliberately glib. But like you say, this movie cannot sustain that, particularly not as it's building towards the climax. At an earlier point, if this was going to work even a little bit, Taylor needed to become credulous.
No, right. No, all this Bing Bong shit is happening right before they go into the never ever. Like, mere minutes elapse before they do the ritual. Jessica has to hurt herself a la the scavenger hunt.
And the craziest thing is that the nanny just rambles for a couple more minutes at Taylor, and somehow it reaches a tipping point, and suddenly Taylor's like, yeah, okay, I'm essentially on board with what you're saying. A shockingly
quick turnaround. Bees was also taken aback by that really, really woeful screenwriting.
The only tiny, insignificant peg that I could try and hang my hat on here is the nanny pulls the rabbit out of her hat by naming Chauncey when theoretically she has not been told the name. And maybe that's supposed to be what gets Taylor on board, but that's pretty thin soup, frankly, as is the entire film, of course.
The whole thing just has such a goofball atmosphere from the nanny's ambush onward. Once the hijacking commences, you really do just like lose cabin pressure and all sense of the movie. I mean, it was never scary, but it's no longer even purporting to attempt to be scary. It's very strange. It starts to feel like an SNL sketch almost. It feels like a parody of an imaginary friend horror movie that doesn't exist, you know? Like, if some mega hit imaginary friend horror movie came out that made, like, Smile money, if that were to happen and then SNL were to do a skit parodying it, this is tonally a lot closer to that. And the detail that clinches that for me is all through this scene, Jessica has a big dollop of green paint on her forehead. It just looks like an inspired moment from the makeup department, like right before she was about to go out in front of the cameras. They were like, wait, one more thing. And now it's comedy gold. Off you go. You know, go knock them dead.
Gold!
So they make it into the never ever, the further. And my assessment of this, you know, it's a kind of M.C. Escher La La Land where up is down and left is sideways, blah, blah, blah. You get the idea. It would be a good setting for a video game. It looks very much like an American Mickey's Alice or a Psychonauts kind of a setting, or like any number of indie horror games on Steam that I've never played, but you know, like Mascot Horror is big right now, or was as of relatively recently. I don't exactly have my finger on the pulse, but it's the kind of liminal wonderland that would be fun to explore and figure out the rule set. And you know, you open a door that shouldn't practically lead to where it does, but through computer magic, you're in this topsy-turvy land of imagination. The movie is basically just them standing in a hallway. I mean, they don't go anywhere. I mean, they do after a certain point, but mostly they just stand around in front of a line of doors and what there's candles, I think, and
or sconces, or and it's around this time that we get the wimpiest, most nothing heel turn of all time.
Yeah,
because the nanny goes over, like they've got their door propped open, you know, door back to reality, and she pulls the doorstop. And then she's like, "Jessica, you left me behind when you came here as a child, and I always wanted to come here, and now we can live here forever." Just on and on and on. It's like, is this meant to be a surprise? I mean, she's been bug fuck nuts from moment one.
Yeah, she acts like a loon right from the jump, particularly when she springs out of the bushes. And I think it's deeper than that even, because as you aptly put it, she is such a hijacker that just on a structural level, she feels antagonist coded because she has taken over the movie in this very no holds barred, aggressive, take no prisoners kind of way. I mean, it feels like a hostage crisis when she's ranting and raving. So then to get into the further and have her go, "Aha, I've been in league with Chauncey Bear this whole time." It's
like, of course you are.
It's a mercy only because she then immediately gets gobbled up and then we don't have to deal with her anymore. I can't think of the last movie character that ground my gears into dust quite like she did.
She has a line that I want to touch on before we move on. I can't quote it directly. Perhaps I should be able to, because I could have taken direct notes. I was alone in the theater. Does not bode well for imaginary. I understand it was on a Thursday afternoon, but like nobody... nothing but me. But anyway, she has this line, something along the lines of, she's talking to Jessica about her father and what happened to her father and why he's gone crazy and had to be institutionalized. It's because he went in to save her, to save Jessica when she was a child and she was in the Never Ever, being chased by Chauncey the spider or whatever. And basically, the dad looked into Chauncey's manifold spider eyes.
It's Pennywise. Exactly. The deadlights and it drives you mad.
Well, the specific explanation here is that he saw into the imaginations of millions of children and he was not strong enough. It's like, what? how many children's imaginations are soul-destroying, sanity expunging mind breakers? None of them.
Well, it's go on.
Well, no, at worst, a child's imagination in my mind is just like irritating. I don't know. It's like, what? This is nonsense. What? Okay, whatever. Go away, kid. Play with whatever. I don't have time with this. And even if I was subjected to a million of those all at once, I'd just be like, get the fuck away from me. This is annoying. My mind is gone.
Because just the sheer volume of thoughts being funneled into one brain, I can see a Lovecraftian thing happening there where it's just too many screaming voices and you crack like an egg and you're never the same person again. But it being children's imaginations specifically, it does feel too whimsical. It feels too Willy Wonka, like it's a world of pure imagination.
And you can't fucking handle it.
Right, but it's like, it needed to be nightmares specifically, like the Willy Wonka tunnel ride, the boat ride to hell.
Yeah.
That might have been something. The idea of him just staring into an abyss of The Wiggles and Avatar The Last Airbender, you know, and the fucking Power Rangers, and being like, no, please. That it's for me, it gets closer to working than it did for you, but it still doesn't cross that line.
Yeah.
So I said this before, there's a bunch of rug pulls where we're meant to think that they made it out. Oh, snap. Never mind. They're still beyond the veil. The first one, the writing is on the wall. Immediately, we see the girl's biological mother, and she's acting like a Stepford wife. She's got this kind of flat affect and this cheerful smile. Actually, she more than anything, she reminded me of Janet from The Good Place. You know, she was like,
which, sure,
not scary. And no. one of the kids is like, she's not real. Yeah, you don't say.
Yeah, I mean, I think, not to give Wadlow any kind of credit or the screenwriters, but I don't think this is meant to be a rug pull yet. There are several rug pulls, but I think this is just where they have found Alice in her prison of what she thinks is happiness.
Right. Well, the final rug pull, I don't mind telling you, actually got me, because it felt like by that point there had been two or three too many of them. And I thought, never in my wildest dreams did I imagine that there was going to be another.
Are we talking about when they're in her dad's room at the...
Yeah.
Okay.
She's
Do we want to just jump to this?
By all means, because I don't have any notes on any of the interim. It's all just a fucking jumble. She's reading her latest Molly Millipede story to her dad. And yeah. Then it's revealed... And this, you know, if I hadn't been completely sour on the movie at this point, this might have given me the creeps. Everyone gets spider eyes. Oh, but crucially, they don't really get spider eyes. They're closer to, like, compound fly eyes. Just these big kind of insectoid, inhuman in any case, eyes. But it's not like they don't do that spidery thing of there being too many eyes of different sizes. So it's off base for me in terms of triggering, you know, an actual arachnophobic reaction. So maybe if they'd executed that a little differently, I might have been sort of ooh. But the movie is too hopeless to make that happen.
Yeah, for sure. So at one point, it appears that they've made it out, and or does this happen? It's all a fucking soup. Anyway, so this scene, the way that Jessica realizes that she hasn't made it out yet, because the whole family circle is there. It's her and her husband and her two stepdaughters and her dad. They're all in the room while she's reading to her dad. And she thinks to check Alice's forearm, which is hidden as it is for most of the movie under like a long sleeve. She's got some kind of scar there, maybe from a burn or something, and we're meant to understand it as having been inflicted by her mother, her biological mother, during one of her psychotic breaks or what have you. And for some reason, Jessica thinks, like, I'm going to check her forearm. And she sees that it's perfectly fine, and that's how she knows that she's still in the never ever. And my question is, what's the character of Jessica? What's her character's motivation to think to check that? And why is that something that the entity would fuck up? Like, why would they get that part of the illusion wrong? That doesn't even make sense. I don't get it.
Yeah, there's a missed opportunity there, I think, to have the tip-off come from the dad, even if he's an imposter dad. You know, if there had been some kind of note of wrongness there that had tipped her off, there would have been some kind of closure or catharsis on the dad front, because there's a lot of unresolved stuff there. All of these characters' relationships are, I mean, none of them are fleshed out, but that one is particularly, you know, especially with the girls having a mom in the sanitarium. There's something going on here with parents losing their marbles and how trying that can be for a child, and just nothing is done with it. I think that would have been the way to maybe show the fissure that she then pries open to realize, oh shit, I'm still in the Matrix, basically. That's yeah. How I would have gone about it.
There's also a bait and switch during one of these several rug pulls that happened in this stretch where Jessica basically tells the two girls, go, he's never going to stop coming after Alice. And so she has this heroic last stand. And ultimately, all she does is, like, give Chauncey a little scratch with a pair of scissors. And then she decides, okay, I can go now.
I bought us enough time.
but it was never supposed to be about buying time. It's like, he's never going to stop coming. The import of that is, like, even if we get out back into the real world, he's just going to find another way in. But you're telling me that now you think you have inflicted such a wound that he's going to be scared? He's like, he goes like, and then he's fine. Like, what are you talking about?
Well, and then the very end of the movie does leave the door open. And it, I mean, it does indicate that they're going to be looking over their shoulders the rest of their lives. Not much of a happy ending. And it's hard to tell if it's being played for laughs. They're like in a hotel lobby, I think, and they see a bear that looks just like Chauncey.
I think it's supposed to be played for laughs.
And so then they book it. They, like, go find a different hotel to check into.
Well, but, and it's not just that either, because as they recede into the background, they're going out the door, and we see them walking down the sidewalk through some windows. This kid is talking to his mom like, I can't even think of what his bear's name is, but so-and-so's hungry. Imaginary friends don't get hungry. Well, he's hungry. He's always hungry. And it's the same. It's Chauncey. It's the same fucking bear.
Yeah, it's not a bad line, actually. I just wish it had come up earlier.
Yeah, but we can get into more after the break, I guess.
Yeah, so we'll take a minute to recoup, because this movie has broken our spirit, shattered our imaginations asunder.
You've been spending time with a new friend? He asked you to do something that hurt you.
That was part of the game.
Does that seem like a game a good friend would want to play?
Maybe we shouldn't play together anymore, Chauncey. Maybe we shouldn't be friends.
No, 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 no.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
She's lost, but we're gonna find her. It was just my
imagination. Every culture has entities that tether to the young. We call them imaginary friends. You are always playing with your imaginary friend. When the connection was severed, the entity becomes enraged.
He says he's right behind you. But it was just my
imagination. And we're back. I turned to bees when they were mucking about in the Never Ever with maybe 10, 15 minutes to go. And I said to them, this movie feels like babysitting. It in the sense, you probably know what I mean by that, but it feels uncannily like you're humoring a child, you know, who's like making up a story for you, and you're like, oh yeah, and then what happens, bud? Oh, that would be that would
be
so
really
scary. That'd be
real.
Wow, god, jeepers. It's just exhausting. Especially if, like me, you're not a kid person. It really is taxing.
And to be clear, Jeff Wadlow just turned 48 years old.
Yes, and this is not his Shark Boy and Lava Girl, as far as I'm aware. He did not let his kids write this.
No, that was his last film, The Curse of Bridge Hollow.
Huh.
Starring Marlon Wayans.
Well, I came out swinging at the top of this episode, and I don't want to bury him 6 feet deep necessarily. I don't think he's any good, but I have kind of gotten my vitriol out of my system already. I should have a proper accounting of his works, a real reckoning. So maybe I'll seek that one out. I doubt it'll cause me to reevaluate, but got to give the man a fair day in court. There is an old YouTube video. It's Nathan Fielder from like a decade or more ago. Old Nathan Fielder video on YouTube where it's a horror trailer that starts with these typical trailer intertitles, you know, a few words a piece, you know, what if one night you fell asleep and found yourself in a nightmare through a drip feed of spooky kind of nighttime bedroom images, a nightmare from which you could not awake. And then the gag is that the text on screen starts getting longer and more intricate every time and stipulating all of these, you know, esoteric rules to do like how the nightmare works and what you have to do to get out of it. And it just kills me. It's like the only way that you can escape is by solving a new puzzle every 10 seconds before you're sucked back into the nightmare. But your memory is getting fuzzier. Also, if you fail too many times, then you become possessed by Sarka, the dream demon. And then you turn into Sarka for 10 seconds out of every minute for the rest of your life. But it just goes on and on and on like that. And I was watching Imaginary thinking like, this is Sarka, the dream demon. Like this is self-parody. It has to be. The nanny just would not shut the fuck up.
No. One, I guess, would be twist that we didn't even touch on is that apparently the bear, the physical teddy bear, is imaginary. It's not actually there.
Oh, right. Only Jessica and what's her name?
Alice
can see it.
And this gets dropped at exactly the same time as the would-be ventriloquism does.
Uh-huh.
So I guess it kind of gets muddled. But Jessica is like, you've seen the bear too, right, Taylor? And Taylor's like, what bear? It's imaginary. And Jessica's like, wait, what? So earnest.
Well, it's confounding because I almost called him the bully character. He's not a bully. He's more of a lech, if anything. But the concussed doofus
right.
appears to see the bear. So God only
yeah.
knows what we're supposed to make of that.
Oh, and I did forget to point out when he comes back, just before the nanny pounces from out the bushes and hijacks the film, Taylor is walking down the street and passes by his house, the doofus's house, and looks up into his window and sees him and might give him a little wave or might just kind of smile, like, even though this guy's a huge doofus and a weirdo, I need a lifeline. And he very ostentatiously closes a pair of inexplicable interior shutters. It just backs away.
I have no memory of that at all.
As I said, he does come back, but not in a way that means anything at all. But yeah, like you say, he can apparently see the bear. So what the fuck? And he's not on any drugs. So dumb. Very dumb.
Yeah. The whole thing is dumb. Nothing means anything. It's chock-a-block with inept scares, which are frequently quite funny. The one that I found funniest is, it's near the end, more than two-thirds of the way through the movie, if I had to guess. Jessica is going over some drawings, I believe from her youth, like a box that she's dug up. And she turns the paper very slowly as the score crescendos. And
right.
you see on the margin of the paper a drawing of Chauncey. And it's like Where's Waldo, but for a doodle of a glum-looking bear. He's just got this kind of mopey expression on his face, and it's accompanied by this horror movie sting that just made me cackle. I mean, it's like the reveal of one of the snowmen in The Snowman, you know? oh, no.
It's meant to be like Jake Gyllenhaal discovering some kind of horrible Zodiac clue in
right.
Zodiac.
Right.
It just does not have that kind of weight at all.
No.
I was struggling during the synopsis to pinpoint exactly where this scene takes place because it's all turned into such a porridge. But I believe it's the actual ending, the actual climax, immediately prior to the closing sting scene at the hotel. Jessica has crawled out of the tiny door, and hot on her heels is Chauncey the bear that then quickly turns into the spider thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got the door closed, and they're trying to cover it up with paint like we see her dad do in the past, earlier on in the climax. And the creature forces the door open and starts dragging her back in. And Alice, like, they knock over, I don't know, like a container of turpentine, I think it's supposed to be. Alice has gotten her hands on some matches. And I guess I've blocked out what her dialogue is exactly, but she's
got this... I think that she says, "You were never my friend. Never, ever."
Oh, God, you're right. Oh, yeah. It's worse than I thought. and she, yeah, she lights the thing on fire. And it's so unutterably dreadful. It's real bad. I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what she says.
Yeah.
And it's just awful. It's like you say, that's some shit that if a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old were writing the script to a horror movie, a script that presumably would come out to about 12 pages because it's a child, that child, if they wrote that line of dialogue, they would think that was so fucking hard. Like, yeah. The hardest possible. Like, dude, that shit is dope. Children don't speak like that, generally. But
I remember being 15 or thereabouts and occasionally hate reading some of the fan fiction that you'd find in the IMDb message boards.
Oh, God.
Where, you know, the people like spitballing ideas for sequels to Jaws or The Exorcist. I have vivid memories of some of those threads. And the funniest one was about a hypothetical Jaws 5. And I remember recounting all of this to a mutual friend and sometimes listener of ours, because I was so tickled by it. The climax of this pitch entailed the shark dying simultaneously every death suffered by all of the sharks in the other installments. So, like, it gets impaled. What? Impaled, electrocuted, blown up, and whatever happens to the shark in Jaws 3D. I can't remember. It's like, and then people were, you know, rightfully ripping into it in the comments, and then it emerged that the author was an 11-year-old or something. You know, it was very like, I am 12 and what is this? And so then it was kind of cute and kind of touching, but like, that is, it still makes you feel like a babysitter.
Yes, you know, that's what I was getting towards, and I was just sidetracked by speaking like a theoretical, self-impressed child.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that just reinforces your point. It is like babysitting. It's dreadful. And it's like babysitting on a not particularly bright day while wearing a pair of sunglasses, because once again, it's a movie that's lit for garbage.
Yeah, right. It's like,
I've been harping on this all the time.
On a rainy day so that you're stuck inside with this over-imaginative twerp.
And you're not allowed to turn on the lights.
Right. And he's
so
just
it's like
you.
There's enough light to kind of see what's going on and you can operate, but you can't see anything real clearly. But it's also not dark in a way that's frightening. It's just annoying. You can't make anything out. And as I said, I've been bitching about this on a variety of episodes of this podcast. I remember I complained about it specifically with Cobweb. There have been others. None of them jump immediately to mind. But it's like, where are all the fucking gaffers? Have they all been raptured somewhere? Like, does no one know how to light a movie anymore?
It's a lost art.
What the fuck? I mean, I'm not expecting everything to be like Jamie Lee Curtis's face during the climax of Halloween, where there's this beautiful splash of light on her face and then everything else is dark. And then there's another splash of light that very naturally seems to just appear on Michael's face. It doesn't have to be at that level, but just make shit legible.
Yeah, we don't expect like masterful chiaroscuro from the likes of Imaginary, but yeah, legible action is a must, unless you're going all the way into like Skinamarink country, and then you can afford to just let us, you know, drown in the grain.
Yeah, that's because the illegibility is the point.
Right.
Yeah, that's part of what's frightening about it. I absolutely do not get the sense from Cobweb or Imaginary or any other film of that ilk, and classing them all together does a little bit of a disservice to Cobweb. I thought that was fair as a film.
Yeah, the slightly freakier spider thing, if nothing else.
Yeah, for sure. But it just seems like you look at these movies and you wonder, are there any lights on set at all? Are they using lighting equipment? Or have they just decided, well, you know, our digital motion picture cameras are advanced enough now where you can, you know, more or less see everything that's going on with just whatever ambient lights around. So we'll just do that. We won't have to pay any gaffers. We won't have to spend the time lighting the scene. So it'll save us some extra shooting time. Is that what's happening? It can't possibly be.
Right.
I'm sure there are lights on set, but that's how it fucking looks.
Yeah, right. And then we'll just tinker with the grade and post like we're editing our vacation photos, just to boost the contrast here or there, or try to make it as pretty as we can. I don't know, having not looked at any behind the scenes anything on this production.
Yeah, I mean, but nor have I, obviously.
It's
baffling.
It was not a priority, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, no. And if you want to make your movie rely solely on natural light, that's a thing that's been done. It's a thing that can look amazing. But your DP has to know what the fuck they're doing. And it has to be painstakingly arranged. And if you don't do that, then you need to put some real effort into artificially lighting your fucking movie to make it work and to make it legible. And they're just not doing it. They're just like, yeah, fuck it. No, we don't need that. Like, well, okay. You just made your shitty movie worse. Congratulations.
I think that there might be this wariness, because these low-budget horror movies, and this one wasn't like a zero budget thing, but it was like all horror movies of its ilk. It's pretty low budget. They're just shot in people's houses. And so maybe there's an insecurity there that if we overplay our hand with regards to, like, you know, if we bring in a bunch of lighting equipment and really just light the shit out of it, it'll look too Hollywood, or people know what the lights in their own kitchen look like. It'll seem unnatural. It'll take them out of it. It does require a certain deftness to artificially replicate the feel of a suburban home, but make it pop in a way that real life doesn't when you're just, you know, making dinner in your own house. I don't know. I think that not like Jeff Wadlow is a born documentarian or anything, but it might be a misplaced instinct to just kind of, you know, just do it for real, man. You know, I don't know. This is pure speculation at this point. But there is a deficiency here. It has to be coming from somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it's absolutely not unique to Jeff Wadlow or to this film. It's just it's an overall malaise in, like, I guess I would call it non-auteur horror films of late. And I hate it.
Workhorse horror.
Sure.
Journeyman horror. Journeyman, thank you. Workhorse horror doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
That workhorse is terrifying.
Well, just kind of turns to applesauce in my mouth when I try to say those syllables in that order.
Workhorse horror. Rural juror.
Yeah, precisely. I am going to recommend Possum, which is a horror movie from some years back that has much more of a painterly kind of look to it, although it is dim and gloomy, very dismal picture, just cinematographically. Nonetheless,
did we watch that together?
We did, but okay. We didn't review it, near as I can recollect.
Well, I think it was substantially earlier than the podcast existed, so that was
It might have been. I know we nabbed it from Family Video.
Yeah.
So RIP. I'm only recommending it on the basis that it has a scarier spider creature in it than what this movie offers up, and it's a toy thing at that. It's a spider puppet, so it's got a little bit of that imaginary friend run amok element that this movie has, but it is consistently a spider or, you know, consistently half a spider. Half spider, half man, half mannequin. And there's not that muddying of the water that you get in this movie, where it's mostly a bear, but then occasionally sprouts four additional legs. It's just nonsense. So check out Possum. It's very low-key, dour, sort of true blue indie, not just low budget, but I mean, you know, it's got independent bones. It's artier. I liked it quite a bit.
I don't know, man. I might just have to take a mulligan on this one.
There is a dearth of good imaginary friend horror movies. Surprise, surprise, because it's a concept that is very easy to shoot yourself in the foot on, I think. It's very easy for it just to become Barney the Dinosaur.
You know, in lieu of giving a recommendation, I'm going to throw out one more beef that I had.
Have at it.
Which is, and it's stupid, but...
He's already dead!
The fact that there was the twist that the physical bear didn't exist deprived me of the opportunity to make a crack about whether the bear was possessed or cursed.
Yeah, we'll have to bring in Ed and Lorraine to make a judgment on that one, make a ruling.
But we can't, because there's no doll. There's no bear.
Yeah.
it's not Annabelle. It's just, well, it's a nothing.
I'm sure they have a term for that, too.
It's a disembodied, I can't even generate the jargon.
It's a non-corporeal tulpa.
I was going in the direction of, like, it's a grade 3, but that's just some Dan Aykroyd shit from Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, boy, does that look bleak.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And not very well lit, wouldn't you know?
What a shock! I think maybe Bill Murray insisted that he not be visible when he says tall, dark, and horny at 12 o'clock. I think that might have been a stipulation in his contract.
Yeah, I want to be wreathed in shadow like Dracula.
So that nobody can identify me.
Plausible deniability.
Well, Chauncey the spider has been burned to death by turpentine. And hopefully he will never return. Judging by the complete absence of other people in my screening. Again, midweek matinee, but also the movie came out less than a week ago. Hopefully that means we won't have any more of these, but you never can tell.
No, Chauncey still hungers.
He's always hungry. Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Imaginary 2024 official trailer, DeWanda Wise, Tom Payne, Tegan Burns, uploaded by Lionsgate Movies. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 31st, and we will be discussing Immaculate, in which Sydney Sweeney plays a nun living in a sinister convent. See you then. Thank you.